You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. My name is Doug Paul. I'm Vice President for Studies and Director of the Asia Program here. It's my privilege this morning to be moderator for a panel on a very important subject with a very distinguished panel of experts. This is a second in a period of increasing cooperation between the Carnegie Endowment and the many distinguished international representatives of the International Monetary Fund. And a new report has been done on China's financial reform, and we're privileged to have present that to us this morning, Nigel Chalk. Looking at Nigel's biography, which all of you have and I won't read, I would really emphasize the episodes in his career, Argentina, Brazil, Korea, and now people are warning us about China. He may go where the crises are, or the crises may follow him. We'll find out. Also, on our panel today is Yukon Huang, who joined us from the World Bank earlier this year here at Carnegie. He's had a lot of experience in Beijing and Moscow and has been developing some very original ideas. And then it's our privilege to welcome from across the street at the Peterson Institute of International Economics, Nick Lardy, who is widely considered the most eminent observer and analyst of Chinese economic affairs, and certainly one of the most eloquent. And with that very brief introduction, let me turn it over to Nigel.
Thanks very much, Doug. Me and crises, I think, are definitely correlation, not causation, so I have to be careful of those things. So we've been doing a lot of work lately, particularly this year, on financial sector issues in China. We've undertaken a financial sector assessment program in collaboration with the Chinese government, which took a very broad look at the financial system. And we've been thinking a lot about where the system is now and where it should go in the coming years. And so I'm going to talk about that in broad terms today. Before I start, let me give you an overview of how we see the financial system in China and the big characteristics that define it. First of all, as everybody knows, China's got very high savings. They're kept captive domestically by capital controls, so you've got a lot of savings sitting inside the domestic financial system. It's a very bank-based system. It's highly regulated in the sense that interest rates, particularly loan deposit rates, are determined by the government directly. Monetary policy is predominantly relies on quantity tools to restrain the pace of credit growth, and the exchange rate is highly managed and leads to a large foreign currency intervention. So this is sort of a broad overview of the system as it is now. And I want to first motivate why financial reform in China is important. I think we think it's as important, for example, as the state enterprise reform that was done in the 90s. It's going to transform the economy, and if it's done right, it will be move China into a much more modern market-based economy. And then I want to talk a little bit about sequencing, which we also think is very important, mainly because we see this underlying exercise of financial reform and liberalization in China is inherently risky. And so getting the sequencing right really matters in order to mitigate some of those risks. So let me start with a little bit of motivation. So the first motivation is, as I said, China controls macroeconomic policy, particularly monetary policy, predominantly through the use of quantity tools, quotas on credit, and particularly quotas on bank credit. Now, what we've seen over the past few years is an increasing amount of intermediation moving outside of the banking system and into non-bank financial system. That inherently is going to reduce the effectiveness of the quantity tools that they use right now to control monetary aggregates. And so we see that there's a risk continuing with the current path. It's not an immediate risk, but it's a present risk in the, say, 3 to 5 year horizon, that the main macroeconomic controls that they have at their disposal actually become much more diluted in their effectiveness. And the concern we have is that reduction in effectiveness of macro controls is that coming exactly at a point when you're actually going to need more macroeconomic policy levers, because demographic changes in China will change the way the labor market works. You're going to see continued and rising inflationary pressures, particularly from food supply. Property price inflation clearly is an ongoing problem that's not going to go away. As I said, you're going to have more non-bank channels for financial intermediation, and all of that's going to boil down to a weakening of the credit control. So the first point to make is financial reform's important because the current system is going to become less effective through time, and that's risky. And the second point I'd make is that we see financial reform as really a critical part of the whole rebalancing agenda. We want to get consumption going in China. We want to get household incomes up. As you can see, China's consumption is way below where other countries would be at China's level of development. It really stands out from an international perspective. And on the right-hand side, there's a picture here that shows that really households are really getting shortchanged on their savings in the banking system. They basically don't get remunerated on those savings, despite the fact that the productivity of capital in China is quite high. So this picture takes a look at the productivity of capital in China and tries to divide it up between households, the banks, and the corporate sector. Who's getting those rents from that productivity? And you can see in China, the red spot is the households, the depositors. They're not getting anything. And effectively, the productivity of capital is being divided up between the banks and the corporate sector, which is quite different from a lot of Asia and certainly from the Western economies. So we think that financial reform in China is an important mechanism, effectively, to take some of those productivity gains out of the corporate sector, to some extent out of the banking sector, and put them in the hands of the households. That will raise household income, and households will then consume that, and you'll facilitate a rebalancing of the economy. In addition, it'll facilitate an increase in the cost of capital, which we see is very low in China, so the cost of capital more closely reflects the productivity of capital, and that will change the incentives to away from heavily capital-intensive investment and towards more labor-intensive means of production. Which will, again, boost household income through labor income. And as I said at the start, the problem is that financial reform in China, it's risky continuing with the current system, but the changing the system is also very risky. And we've seen from international experience lots, and I've been involved in a few of these countries, although not, as I said, not causal. I was a child when this was happening, so it couldn't possibly be. But you've seen in a lot of countries that have moved towards liberalization, particularly liberalization of interest rates, what happens is they lose control of the monetary aggregates. So as you liberalize interest rates, they unintentionally inject an enormous amount of credit and monetary stimulus into the economy. So you see here cases of interest rate liberalization. The starting point is where they began to liberalize interest rates. And then you see credit growing and growing and growing, and eventually the little square dot is when they end with a banking crisis. So you end up with a big injection of stimulus to the economy, eventually all those loans go bad and you have a big banking crisis. And it's pretty clear that the countries that have liberalized interest rate correctly, as they liberalized, they actually tightened monetary conditions and they drove up the real rate of interest. The ones on the left-hand side, the Argentina, Chile, and Mexico, which ended up with problems, these are the ones that actually injected stimulus into the economy as they were liberalizing. So that's the risk, is the process of liberalization itself will actually create overheating pressures, asset bubble pressures, non-performing loan pressures in the economy. So you're faced, as a policymaker in China, you're faced with two options. You keep with the current system, which works pretty well, but you know it's going to become less effective over time. Or you try and switch to another system, which you know that process of switching itself is a risky venture. And that's a complicated decision to make from a political economy perspective. So this is how we see the main motivations for financial reform. One is to preserve macro control, and two is to facilitate rebalancing in the economy. So I want to just talk briefly about sequencing. Now, normally in China, as many of you know, the approach to reform tends to be gradualist and tends to be experimental in nature. So they'll do pilot cases, they'll do experiment in one province with a particular type of reform. Our concern is that approach to reform, while well-suited for things like healthcare reform or reform of the VAT, is not well-suited for financial sector reform. You can imagine, for example, experimenting with allowing some banks more freedom to set interest rates on deposit and loan rates in some provinces or certain banks. That's going to create huge incentives for arbitrage and huge potential instabilities in the system. So we think it's very important that there's a clear game plan going into the process of financial reform and a clear strategy that will have to be flexible because there's going to be some unexpected events along the way, but has to have a clear roadmap. And we've tried to define what we think that roadmap will be. And there's basically six components that I'm going to go through. The first one is the exchange rate. China could not engage in financial reform if it's continually injecting 300 billion dollars of reserve accumulation a year into its financial system. It's just too much of a push of liquidity into the system. It's going to create too many pressures. So really, to move ahead with financial reform, there needs to be currency appreciation. To reduce the amount of foreign currency intervention, to reduce the scale of BOP inflows into China. Having more flexibility in the currency, and particularly appreciation of currency, will also mean that you don't need to use reserve requirements as they are used now purely as a tool to sterilize the foreign currency intervention. You'll actually be able to use monetary tools in a way to exercise monetary policy rather than offset the reserve accumulation. And so that will give you a greater scope for an independent monetary policy. As I'm going to discuss, in order to liberalize the financial system, you're going to need to have an independent and strong monetary policy along the way in order to contain this expansion of credit that the system is normally naturally going to facilitate. So we see this as a really important prerequisite to moving ahead with financial reform. The second thing is the monetary framework. As I said, right now, a lot of the monetary framework is exercised through the use of quantity controls on credit to restrain monetary aggregates. As you can see, inflation moves around quite a lot in China, and interest rates really don't move very much in response to inflation. That's because the countercyclical forces of monetary policy are really driven by quantities and not by interest rates, and interest rates are not used very actively. In addition, as I said before, reserve requirements are much more linked to sterilizing foreign currency intervention than to actual use of monetary policy. So it's a strange monetary policy framework. It's something that's not common, particularly not common in an economy this size. So our view is that first, steps in order, before you begin the process of liberalization, is that you have to absorb the liquidity in the system. Right now, there's an enormous amount of hidden liquidity in the system that's not reflected in market prices, because, as I said, interest rates are regulated in the economy. If you start liberalizing now with all of that liquidity sitting in the system, it's going to turn into loans and it's going to create overheating pressures and asset bubbles. So first of all, you have to absorb the liquidity, and you do that by issuing central bank paper and driving up interest rates. If you look at central bank paper interest rates, like the one-year interest rate right now, it's very, very close to the deposit rate. What you need to do is push that interest rate higher and higher in order the banks become short liquidity and they start making appropriate decisions on liquidity management and the allocation of credit. So that's the first step. The second thing is you're going to have to start thinking about a different monetary policy framework. If you're going to give up quantity controls, direct quantity controls, if you're going to have a more flexible exchange rate, and you're going to do it at a time when you're reforming the financial system and monetary aggregates become very unstable, you're going to have to move towards a different kind of system that neither targets the exchange rate nor monetary aggregates as a nominal anchor. And our view is that there should be some kind of a hybrid system that looks at, has clear targets on growth, inflation, and financial stability. And it uses a combination of monetary tools, particularly interest rates, and macroprudential tools in order to achieve those targets. But particularly a lot more reliance on indirect instruments of monetary policy, open market operations. And as part of that, it would be important also for operational autonomy for the central bank. So the third step is improving regulation and supervision. Along with giving banks more ability to set interest rates, more freedom to allocate credit, there needs to be a very strong regulatory and supervisory environment. We've seen here in the US where regulation and supervision didn't keep up with the pace of financial innovation, didn't keep up with the intermediation that was happening, you ended up with huge problems. So it's really, there's been huge progress in China in the last several years on regulation and supervision, adopting international standards, having a very professional regulatory bodies. And there's a lot that still needs to be done. So I'll just point out a few of these aspects. I think one thing is going to be very important is to have a coordinating body that coordinates all of the financial regulators, because you're going to see increasing moves out of the banking system into the non-bank system, into the securities markets, into corporate debt markets. And so you're going to need to have a holistic view of financial regulation driven by a central coordinating body at a very high level. The second thing is on crisis management framework. You're going to need to have the tools to handle problems as you liberalize the problems that arise. So that's going to mean things like being able to take over weak institutions and have an orderly exit process, which currently doesn't exist, having a formal deposit insurance scheme. These are sort of normal tools we see in market economies that China still doesn't have in place. Having emergency liquidity support facilities of the central bank. They're automatic for banks that temporarily hit liquidity constraints but don't have solvency problems. So all of these things will be necessary to manage the process of liberalization as it moves along. The fourth thing is market development. I'm not going to talk detail about that, but market development in China, in addition to moving ahead with reform of the banking system and the financial system, it'll also be important to build a very well-regulated and healthy non-bank financial intermediary system. Currently, there's a number of problems in the financial system. Money markets don't work very well. You see a lot of volatility in money markets. Corporate bond markets are very segmented with exchange-traded and interbank bond markets. Securities markets need a lot of work in terms of improving liquidity. All of these are fairly technical things. So the main point I want to make on market development is it'll be very important that as you move ahead with market development, it moves in parallel with the liberalization in the banking system. If you move market development faster, you allow more ability to intermediate outside the banking system, and you don't change what's happening in the banking system, which is sort of what's happening now. You run the risk that funds migrate out of the banking system and into the non-bank system, and then you undermine your banking system as a result. So it's very important that this is, as I said, a sequence and coordinated strategy, that you move all the aspects of financial reform along together at a similar pace. Finally, interest rates. So once you have a flexible exchange rate, you have a coherent monetary framework linked to growth, inflation, and financial stability. You've absorbed the liquidity that's currently resident in the banking system through open market operations, and you've got a good set of regulatory and supervisory structures, then you can move ahead with liberalizing interest rates. If you do it before that, the risk is as you liberalize interest rates, twofold, the banks will start competing heavily for funds, compress their margins, and then the banks get into trouble. Or you get a surge of credit into the economy as the banks use all the liquidity that they have on their balance sheets and start lending it. So liberalizing interest rates comes somewhat later in the schedule, I think, than many people think. But I think there's a lot of preconditions that need to go in place before you start doing that. In terms of how to liberalize interest rates, I would focus more on the deposit rate ceiling. So we think, which is, I think, is not a view in China, but we think what you want to do is as you liberalize interest rate, you also want to raise the cost of capital. You want to tighten monetary conditions. So it seems natural that you should raise the deposit rate ceiling. You tighten monetary conditions in order to absorb the liquidity to drive interest rates up. And as you do that, the loan rate floor that they currently have on banks will just become less and less binding. The banks will start pricing loans more and more above the floor, and eventually the loan rate floor won't matter. Once you get interest rates closer to equilibrium, deposit rates higher, eventually you can start removing the deposit rate ceiling too. And as I said, the whole game as you move along this process is to tighten monetary conditions, restrain credit growth, raise the cost of capital. That has to be part of the whole process. And then the final aspect of this sort of broader financial reform plan is capital account liberalization. And we see this as coming fairly late in the game. Certainly there's a lot that can be done right now on internationalizing the renminbi, and there's a lot of progress being made. But real capital account liberalization, where you allow more and more flows coming in and out across the capital account, will really have to wait until you have a financial system that's much more price-based. You have a good monetary framework, you have a good regulatory framework. They do have the tools right now in terms of QDII, QFII tools, where they can gradually open up holes in the capital account and allow flows to come through. As usual, we think you open up the longer-term non-debt creating flows first. You leave the portfolio flows till later. But you can't move ahead with capital account convertibility until you sort out the broader financial system. So that's... I kept within 15 minutes, which was pretty good. So that's unusual for me. But now I'm going to turn it back to Doug, and I'd like to hear from Yukon and Nick as well.
Well, that really was a rather breathless tour through the... I remember when I was in the Navy, when they gave us instructions like this, they took several weeks to... I think we'd agree that Nick would go second.
Well, I very much share Nigel's assessment of the situation and the kind of strategy moving forward. So I thought I'd spend a few minutes to talk a little bit more about the political economy aspects of the question. Why haven't the Chinese started on this earlier? Why have they waited so long? What are the constraints on undertaking the kind of reform program that we just heard laid out, I thought, very, very well. I begin by noticing that China was beginning a process of interest rate liberalization in the late 1990s. They continued it through 2004, but there has been very, very little progress since then. The whole process essentially came to a halt. Wen Jiabao has talked about interest rate liberalization. It was an objective that was spelled out in the 11th five-year plan that is coming to an end. It's also an objective that's very clearly identified in the 12th five-year plan. So this is something they started on, then paused, a rather long pause, and now they're talking more about doing it. But it's very hard to see that any real progress or anything concrete has happened since late 2004. And so I'd like to talk just very briefly about, you know, why they won't move on the exchange rate, why they won't move on interest rate liberalization. And I think that there are a couple of common explanations in the political economy literature on China, and people talk about all the time. And one is that there's this misalignment of interest between the central government on the one hand and localities on the other. And we see this in many, many domain. So the central government announces policies, but you don't get the follow-through at the local level. We see this, for example, on intellectual property rights protection. China has a great system of laws and regulations on these subjects, but they're not enforced at the local level. The local levels are interested in the employment and the tax revenues and so forth that are generated by firms that are pirating intellectual property. You periodically have crackdowns that are orchestrated from the central level, but once these are over, it's back to business as usual in the provinces, and nothing really much happens. I don't think this framework really tells us very much about why China hasn't moved ahead more on the exchange rate and interest rate liberalization. These are two policy, and I mean, you don't need boots on the ground at the local level to reform the interest rate structure, reform the whole process of setting interest rates, or the exchange rate. These are policy instruments that are entirely controlled at the central level, and once they are changed, I believe there will be a very substantial reaction at the local level, because most of the activities that these prices affect are in the private sector. Nigel mentioned property development. I'm in the school of thought that says interest rate repression, these very low deposit rates, has led a large number of households to invest in multiple houses, because the return on housing has been very, very high over the last 5 or 6 years, whereas return on bank deposits has been negative. But once you change, once you change the interest rate policy and the real return to deposits goes up, and the advantage of housing, owning housing over other kinds of financial instruments disappears, the housing market is going to correct. And local government officials, party secretaries, and so forth at the local level may be very unhappy about this. They're going to, construction activity will decline or grow at a much slower rate. They're going to lose tax revenues. The revenue from the leasing of land will dry up. But I don't think there's anything they can do about it, because local party officials can't force people to buy their third or fourth house if they don't want to own one. And all of the property activity is undertaken by private companies. If you go back 15, 20 years ago, most construction was undertaken by state-owned companies. That's not the case today. 80% of all the construction activity in China is carried out by private firms. So they will respond to price signals like a change in interest rates. And it's the same thing on the exchange rate. The dominant source of exports from China today, or the growth of exports in China today, is coming from private firms. Foreign-funded firms are still important. They are also very profit-oriented. And state firms, which back in the mid-90s accounted for about two-thirds of Chinese exports, now only account for about 15-20% of China's exports. So again, this is an area where private sector activity dominates. So if the currency appreciates and exporting becomes less profitable, these firms will scale back their activities. If the exchange rate appreciates more, they'll exit from the businesses, and there will be a response. China's export surplus, I believe, would diminish, and resources would be gradually allocated into other sectors of the economy. And if we read the reports that the IMF has put out, there are very substantial prospects for increasing employment in the service sector. So this need not have a very large effect on employment overall. So this idea that the structural problem here is that central government can't align the incentive structure at the local level to make sure that its mandates are carried out, I don't think applies in the policy domain that we're addressing this morning. I think the alternative explanation, which is either that, you know, China is a much more consensus-based political system and they can't get agreement on reforms in these areas, or you could put it another way, you know, you have weak central leadership that can't is subject to conflicting advice on the issues that we're talking about. I find that much more persuasive. I think the problem, quite frankly, has been that in the Hu Jintao Wen Jiabao era, we've had no significant market-oriented reform initiatives. We have an increasingly market-driven economy, I think, but it's really running off momentum of earlier reforms rather than a response to significant new initiatives that have occurred under the current leadership. So, and I think also it's very clear that we see lobbying against the kinds of reforms that we're talking about this morning. The Ministry of Commerce, a lot of other special interests have repeatedly given terrible advice to the top leadership about what the consequences of exchange rate appreciation would be. In the spring of 2010, for example, when they were debating whether or not to go off their fixed exchange rate policy, which they finally did do in June of 2010, the spokesman for the Ministry of Commerce said the most important thing is exchange rate stability. And he said that it would be 2 to 3 years before China recovered. First of all, he said there were going to be deficits in the trade account as they went through 2010, and that it would be 2 to 3 years before China recovered to the level of exports that it had prior to the global financial and economic crisis. In the reality, as we moved through 2010, there was only 1 month in which there was a trade deficit. China's exports expanded for the year as a whole by more than 30%. That's about 3 to 4 times the growth of global trade that year. And China's exports in 2010 were way above the previous peak. So you get the Ministry of Commerce consistently over a period of years forecasting doom and gloom if the exchange rate changes. And the results usually conclusively prove that the advice that they gave is wrong, but they still seem to be quite influential in the determination of exchange rate policy. That's why even since policy changed in 2010, the currency, while appreciating a little bit against the dollar, about 6%, has continued to depreciate on a real trade-weighted basis. So we don't see the kind of adjustment in the exchange rate that I think Nigel correctly points out is more or less a precondition for moving ahead with interest rate liberalization and a number of other reforms that are very important to this overall rebalancing agenda. So I'm not very optimistic that the situation's going to change. I think the system has become more financially repressive over the last year, as you saw from one of the diagrams. Real deposit rates are declining very, very rapidly over the course of 2011. The implicit tax in the household sector is going up. It's very unlikely that consumption gains are going to be significant, just like they were not too significant last year. The current leadership, which has shown very little appetite for fundamental economic reform, is quite frankly running out the clock. They don't want to do anything before 2012. And we'll have to wait and see what the new leadership that comes in 2012, what their appetite is for moving ahead along the very sound path that I think has been outlined this morning. But I fear that, as is frequently the case, it will take them a year or two to figure out what to do. So we're maybe looking at another 2 or 3, 4 years in which the situation, in my view, deteriorates. We get a continued buildup of liquidity in the banking system, which is adverse for the kinds of economic reform that we're talking about. We're still seeing massive increases in the buildup of foreign exchange reserves, even though the trade surplus has come down. The tax on households, the implicit tax on households, is going up. And the kind of distortions, in the excessive investment in the property market is, if anything, accelerating. China now has a level of property investment that's in the first half of this year about 9% of GDP, up from 4 or 5% before financial repression really got going. This is an astronomically high level. If you go back and look at Taiwan, for example, in its period of very rapid growth and urbanization, the average rate of investment in housing was 3%, and the peak was 4%. India has gone from 3 to 5, but China is at 9 and rising rapidly, in my judgment, with not much end in sight, given the kind of financial distortions that have taken hold in the system over recent years. So on that...
9% of GDP or 9% of...
The investment figures in housing are a percent of GDP. So on that happy note, I will surrender the floor and turn it over to you, Ken.
Okay. I'm sitting here between two experts on the financial sector, and I begin by saying I agree with both of them in terms of their analysis. And I'm going to bring you, however, a slightly different perspective of what's been happening in China, and it may explain a little bit about why China isn't going to move very rapidly on some of these issues. But it may also cause you to think a little bit differently about the question of imbalances and growth in China. And then at the end of this, you'll probably be more confused than you began. So let's begin. And let me begin by taking a historical perspective of where this all came from. And it came from Deng Xiaoping. And I call him the unbalanced reformer. And what did Deng Xiaoping do 30 years ago? He basically said, I wanted to concentrate production, exports, economy scale specialization along the coast. But Deng Xiaoping... 20 years, 30 years ago, basically said, I got a problem. I don't have any money. So how am I going to do this? And if you look at the fiscal system, you basically see that the budget revenues in China are collapsing as they move from the socialist system to the market system, hitting only about 10% of GDP by the mid-90s. And yet, China and Deng Xiaoping had these glorious ambitions of increasing investment infrastructure along the coast. So he said to himself, can I get this from the budget? And the answer is he couldn't get it from the budget. And he couldn't get it from the budget because incomes are too low to tax household incomes. The sales tax, too costly to administer, too cumbersome to actually implement. And actually, if you put it into the Chinese system, it's a very regressive tax. And then the revenues accrue to localities and very hard to manage. So the beginnings of financial repression and some of the problems that Nigel and Nick are talking about essentially began with the view of why don't I use the banking system to get resources? I keep interest rates low. I give households few investment alternatives. The banks get all this money. And there are only a few big banks. I'll tell them where to spend it. I'll tell them to spend on industry, infrastructure. And this just turns out to be a progressive tax system. Because by offering low interest rates, I basically are taxing the richer households more than the poor. So they start off by saying, this is actually a better system raising money. It's more progressive. I have more control. And instead of using the fiscal system, I use the banking system. And it's very, very efficient. And essentially, that's the China story. Extraordinarily efficient channeling of resources, supplemented by incentives, tax policies, special export zones along the coastal areas, pour all the money into those coastal provinces, allow 200 million migrant workers to move to the coastal areas, and bang, you get an extraordinarily rapid growth. It goes from 4 or 5% of GDP to 10%. Now, the interesting thing about this diagram is the spatial nature. Growth stagnating accelerates to an average of 10%, which is this red line. but led by the coastal areas because Deng Xiaoping wanted to put all his resources along the coast. And this is the Tiananmen period. Aside from the Tiananmen period, what is extraordinary in China is that over the last 20 years, growth has never fallen below 8% a year. There's no country in the world that has that kind of stability in terms of rapid growth. And then look what's happening today. Regionally, the coastal, central, inland regions are now converging, and the western region is actually growing faster than the coastal region. So this is an extraordinary divergence and convergence to a very rapid growth, and that's basically Deng's strategy of growth and acceleration. And it led to this rapid increase in investment financed by financial repression, but this dramatic decline in the rate of consumption. So this is the so-called image of China's unbalanced growth strategy. And it carries a very negative image because it looks like consumers are being repressed. It looks like the economy is overinvesting. But what we've already seen right now, of course, is it's growing extremely rapidly because of the strategy. Now let's look at the decline in consumption of GDP of China. And this is the black line. This dramatic decline in consumption share of GDP is at the heart of the unbalanced growth strategy. But if you look at Japan, Taiwan, Korea, back in their industrialization phase, you see that China's decline is essentially the same. So the real question is China's decline a sign of inefficiencies any more than decline in Japan, Taiwan, and Korea was a sign of inefficiencies? Well, the first thing you realize is the decline is more or less the same, but what is really different about China is that its absolute level was so low to begin with. Now, obviously, if it began so low, it ends relatively low. So what is really strange about China is why this curve was so low to begin with rather than the decline, which is actually quite normal. Now, I've argued in other papers that part of the reason that line is so low is statistical discrepancies, which explains about half the decline. But there is a real part of the decline which is real. And consumption as a share of income fell over the last decade because savings out of disposable income rose and people consume less. And disposable income out of GDP fell, and therefore disposable income, household disposable income, if it falls as a share of GDP, people have less money and they consume less. Now, are these problems? Well, what I'm going to show you is that some of these are really inefficiencies and problems, but some of these changes actually are quite good and quite beneficial. And the consequences are much more complex, but probably better understood from a spatial and structural perspective. Let me begin by looking at savings rates. This is the increase in savings rates in the economy as a whole, and these are the increased savings rates of households. Now, the increased savings rates in China is not a problem of rural households. They're actually falling. So the first thing we realize is a spatial issue. The increasing savings rates in China is due to the increased savings rates in the urban households. So to the extent that Chinese are consuming less and saving more, it's an urban phenomenon. And as Nigel and Nick and others have mentioned, part of the reason that they're saving more is they're worried about the social welfare system and the long-term security, and therefore they're saving more even though the government's actually strengthening social security. So this has a perverse effect of saving more. But there's another reason why urban savings rates have really soared, and actually is actually more important, but no one ever talks about it. And it's very simple. You have 200 million migrants living in the coastal areas. Their savings rates are approximately 40% of their income. The saving rates of others, the people who are entitled to live in these places, is 20%. And so as you go from zero migrants to 200 migrants, and you look at the numbers, it turns out that it explains half the increase in urban savings rates. And what's the solution? The solution is that you have to actually allow them to live there and be formally registered and have hukou, and then they'll start spending more in line with others. But right now, they have no incentive to spend. They just save. So that's one of the problems in there in terms of the imbalances in the savings rates. Now, the other problem is that disposable income has been falling as a share of GDP. And if disposable income falls as a share of GDP, then consumption as a share of GDP falls because you basically consume out of your household income. And this is a major factor. Now, the interesting thing about this fall, which many people have written about, it turns out that this fall is very strange in China. This fall in disposable income is totally explained by the decline of disposable income in one region in China, and that's the West. Now, everyone's image of China is the coastal provinces. So when they talk about consumption falling or share consumption falling, they tend to think about the coast. But actually, the share of disposable income falling as a share of GDP is explained by the fact that in the far West, it used to be almost 90% of the GDP in the Western regions was going to households. It fell to 50, whereas the other three regions, it's been gradual. And this particular regional decline explains about 60%, 70% of the decline in household income as a share of GDP. Now, that's very, very strange. And then when you would say, why did it start only 10 years ago? How come it didn't occur before? And it was because of China's Develop the West strategy, and it was because of the surge in commodity prices. Rapid growth, which we saw in the earlier diagram in the West, basically meant that GDP growth was very rapid, but the share of labor income in the West was actually falling dramatically. But there's a very strong spatial aspect. Now, why did the shift, the industrialization process, the rural-urban migration, why did this lead to a reduction in consumption? It, of course, led to a reduction in consumption because household income fell. Now, this is logically what's happening in China. Over time, people are moving out of agriculture, so agriculture is becoming less important. Services are becoming more important. Industry is becoming more important. That's what you would expect, and that's true. Now, this is household or labor share of income in each of these sectors. Agriculture is 90%. In construction, it's about 70%. In services, it's about 55%. In industry, it's more like 45%. Now, as people move out of agriculture into industry and services, they move from agriculture and they're moving into industry and services, the labor share of production, the share that households get out of GDP, falls. And that's sort of counterintuitive, but when you think about it, it's quite obvious. You have a farmer moving from a rural area. He's paid very little. He's growing his farm. It all accrues to him. He goes to industry. He makes twice as much. But of course, he's contributing to an industry which is generating a lot of profits, so a large chunk of those profits accrue to capital, to land, or rent. So as China rapidly grows, invests, industrializes, labor share of income declines, and so does consumption of GDP declines. And that, I think, is a positive issue and positive development. That's part of the reason why China's growing very rapidly. But the consequence is this imbalance, which is seen very negatively. Now, the other thing which is very strange in China is the labor share in industry is declining. In most countries, labor share in industry doesn't decline. It goes up. Wage rates, wage unions, bargaining powers increases wages. So why is labor share in industry declining? And the answer is because the private sector is getting more important in China. The public sector is overstaffed and they pay more. Private companies are not so richly staffed and they pay less. So as the private sector in China gets more important and becomes more dominant industry, the great irony is that labor share of income in industry falls. But this is probably a desirable outcome because it's becoming more private, becoming more efficient. So these are kind of very strange things happening in China. And when these things, this transition from agriculture to industry, when industry's private sector becomes totally dominant or stabilizes, you're going to find that household income will start to turn up and consumption will turn up. This is going to take a long time. Now, I wanted to show you two things. This unbalanced growth strategy has problems, of course. It creates tremendous inequalities. The Gini coefficient is soaring. The urban-rural income ratio is soaring. The regional disparities are soaring. But one thing which is not a problem, which people will focus on, is that consumption, household consumption per capita in China, the red line, is the highest in the world growing. Higher than India, higher than the upper middle income countries, higher than Korea, Brazil, and obviously much higher than high income countries. So although it's an unbalanced strategy which creates a lot of inequities and disparities, it's not a strategy that actually represses consumption. This consumption is growing incredibly rapidly. Now, one final point I would make is this is a real problem for the what I would call trying to get reform in China, because there are many leaders who actually don't think the financial repression is a problem. It leads to rapid growth, tremendously high increases in consumption. Imbalances are structural and spatial, difficult to deal with. And it causes a lot of ambiguity in China in terms of, do I need to change, do I not need to change? And that is a big issue in China. Thank you.
Thank you, Yukana. Thank you, Nick, for your commentaries. To an extent I hadn't expected, you've really thrown fat in the fire on what is the problem? And I'd like to ask you, what is the problem and what does it mean for the U.S. as we go forward? Nick has suggested that the ambitious sequenced reforms that Nigel has laid out after a very careful and thorough study may be held up for the next 3-4 years by the transition in the leadership and the bottlenecks that we have all seen in Chinese decision-making. And Yukon, I think you're suggesting that it's not as bad as we think it is, that we can get through this. I'd be interested to start off the Q&A before I turn to the audience, and any comments you have on the relevant. Yes, please.
Well, my comment, Doug, is I think you need to check the water in this building. I used to have these debates about financial repression with Mr. Keidel, who is also a big proponent of financial repression. Thought it was wonderful. And now, Yukon's the same thing. Vikram, you better watch out.
Go ahead.
On two things. One on the prospects of reform. I guess I share with Nick the concern that, particularly with the political transition, it won't move ahead. Partly, as Nick said, I think because it's become a consensus-driven system in making decisions. And this is a big, big reform. It's hard to imagine that so big reforms like, say, enterprise reform could happen today in China. You need decisiveness. You need a real clear path of where you want to go. I think our concern is that we see the sort of overall reform program as being, you know, something in the order of 5 years is going to take to get through this. It's not a quick fix. It's going to take many years to build the institutions, to build the monetary policy framework, to unwind this very complex system that they have right now. And so our concern is that not it's going to be a problem today, but if they don't start investing today in this project, in 5 years' time, it's going to be too late. And that's when the pressures will really build up, and that's when they're going to have a big problem. And then just a comment on what Yukon said. I agree. I mean, this natural process of urbanization, moving people off the land, we expect that to reduce labor income to some extent. I think the problem in China, though, is it's being kind of supercharged in a way. Because the cost of capital is so low, that means that industry becomes much more capital intensive than it should be for an economy as endowed as China is with labor, which means that the returns to labor from production are much, much lower than they would be if relative prices were correct, in some sense, in China. And it really, you know, as Nick says, this really is a system that is designed to tax households and tax labor and use that tax to subsidize corporate investment, subsidize banks, and subsidize sterilized intervention. And that's a distortion in relative prices that I think is the problem. I don't think it's necessarily a problem that, you know, the urbanization process leads to a production function that's less labor intensive as there's less agriculture in the production. But the problem is that the distortion in relative prices makes it way, way too capital intensive, which is why we worry now that you could see an external rebalancing in China, but driven entirely by investment. And that's a risky proposition, that because the cost of capital is too low and becoming increasingly low in real terms, that just facilitates more and more investment. And at some point, you have to hit the end of the road with that. At some point, that investment leads to excess capacity, leads to all sorts of environmental problems. It leads to non-performing loans in the banking system. And that's not a healthy model of development. It's not an imminent problem, but it's a problem if you look, say, 5 years out.
Yeah, it's not actually that I recommend financial repression. I'm basically sort of like going through and saying, what choices does the government have to get resources going back over the three decades? And for many countries with really weak fiscal systems, they basically have to resort to the banking system. And this is true for many of these Asian countries, not just China. Now, even today, although the fiscal system in China is much stronger, its collection of revenues as a share of GDP is about 10 percentage points lower than most lower middle income countries. So its fiscal system is still relatively undeveloped, because ideally it should be funding some of these things, they fund through the banks, through the budget. So my view would be actually that the financial repression issue is not likely to be solved unless they get the fiscal system in hand strong enough. And that gives them the confidence to actually fund a lot of these things that they're funding through the banks, funding it through the budget. And if they did it through the budget, some of these things they probably wouldn't fund because it'd become more transparent and some of these things are problems. Through the banks, they're not so transparent. So I guess in terms of sequencing, I actually agree with Nigel and the fund's recommendation in terms of financial reforms, but I think it's very difficult for the Chinese to actually do that unless they have confidence that they have the kind of control or resources to do the things they want to do, because we know they will do that. And that's, I think, a big problem in China.
Thank you for those. I'm no economist, as you know, but I have been around long enough to have seen a lot of crises develop. And what you're describing in China reminds me of a few points at which rapidly growing economies that relied heavily on low-cost investment, access to capital, reached a point where it didn't work anymore, and they became they fell into a period of static growth, such as Japan has been in for now almost two decades, or experienced real crises, such as Southeast Asia in 1997, Taiwan and Korea in their own ways. But you guys are too sober to predict a big crisis for China. You're too responsible. But I think we ought to have that in mind as something that may accompany this period of transition in China. I'd also mention two new volumes that for some of the audience may be unfamiliar, not from Carnegie. One is Ezra Vogel from Harvard University's new biography of Deng Xiaoping, which takes a top-down look at the rapid reforms that antedated the discussion we're having today and how China got to where it is now. And a less well-known book, Red Capitalism, by a former colleague of mine, Paul Walter, and the J.P. Morgan Bank, and a guy named Howie, his co-author, which looks at the point at which the financial reforms Nick Lardy was talking about in his comments transition to an end to that reform period, and details the people and the how and whys that this happened. That might be interesting background reading. But now I'd like to throw the questions open to the floor, and there's a first hand one up here on the aisle.
Thanks.
Please identify yourself and your affiliation. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for taking my question. My name's Matt Schuhl. I'm from Inside U.S. Trade. And I wanted to re-ask something that the moderator had mentioned is, what are the implications here for U.S. policy? Vice President Biden was just in China, and he mentioned the issue of financial reform. I'm not sure how much of an emphasis he put on that. So that's the first part of the question. The second one is, at the same time, you have U.S. financial firms pressuring the U.S. government to, get China to open up their financial market to our companies so we can participate there. And I'm not an economist either, so I'm just kind of wondering how that fits in with the type of reforms that you're talking about. At what stage do you have U.S. financial firms, China opening up its market to U.S. financial firms? Or what stage do you recommend that? Thanks.
On the U.S. interest, I mean, I think the fundamental interest, not just for the U.S., but international community, is, as I said, that you've never had an economy this big, this systemic, with this kind of financial system. And reforming the system and doing it wrong, and as Doug said, ending up with volatility, crises, that's nobody's interest, because if China has a problem in their financial system, that's a global problem, and it's going to be a U.S. problem. So I think, there's a fundamental interest for financial reform to happen and to happen in a way that's safe, it's well-controlled, well-sequenced. That ultimately, I think, is the U.S. interest. In terms of U.S. participation in the financial system, clearly U.S. obviously is already in the Chinese financial system, but I don't see this as much about sort of foreign access and foreign participation in the financial system as much as really about the domestic system itself and reform of that domestic system. Foreign players are a small part of the system. I can see that they can be very helpful, for example, in developing non-bank financial intermediaries, pensions, mutual funds, other types of financial intermediation. But the fundamental problem really is one of a domestic financial players.
I basically agree with that. I think the prospects that China is going to throw its market open to U.S. financial institutions to do a range of things that they haven't been able to do in the past is probably pretty limited. I mean, and I do think, as Nigel said, the emphasis really has to be on domestic financial reform, from which we will all benefit, and, you know, very basic things like, you know, having a more flexible interest rate and exchange rate environment. I felt for years when several U.S. Treasury secretaries, you know, in the run-up to the global financial crisis, were going to China many times per year and telling the Chinese they ought to allow foreign financial institutions to play a better role, bigger role, and introduce more sophisticated financial products, and et cetera, et cetera. I was always critical of this because I felt you need to get the basics first, and the basics, you know, means getting rid of some of the underlying distortions, for example, in the interest rate structure or the exchange rate structure, and that you couldn't layer on a lot of more sophisticated products in an environment where there was a high degree of control, a bureaucratic control of interest rates. So I think they should move ahead on the reforms, and that at the appropriate time, then they'll be able to open up to more fully to the participation of international financial institutions.
I think the U.S. interest certainly is for China to reform the financial sector to make it more open. I think the problem is that today, any U.S. position on this is seen increasingly negatively by the Chinese because they look at the Western economies and all they see is financial crises. So they're actually less convinced about this message today than they were 3 years ago. So taking a U.S. perspective, what would be a message which the Chinese would find positive, which would be consistent with U.S. interests? And that message is that both sides probably are interested in the Chinese renminbi becoming more international. And the U.S. and China has a personal interest, political, financial interest in the renminbi becoming used as international currency. But the prerequisite for that is a more liberal and reformed financial sector. And the prerequisite for that is an exchange rate which probably appreciates, becomes more flexible. So the message really is, China, if you're interested in making the RMB a more of an international currency, to make that possible, you have to reform the financial system, exchange rate policies, and that serves your own interests. And I think that particular slant, I think, would be probably how I would discuss it from a U.S. perspective, rather than saying you have to reform your financial sector and liberalize capital flows, because they look at that and say, well, these, what's going on is because capital markets are open, people are liberalized, they all got into trouble. I think that is, this particular point, a difficult message.
The aisle here, the blue. I'm Helen Raphael. I worked for 5 years in China, and I'm resources for the future person. Since Yukan Huang slipped in his initial talk the words fiscal policy, I'm just wondering whether the development of Social Security and Medicare wouldn't, in fact, greatly increase consumer spending and, in fact, decrease the desire to invest in housing in order to provide for the future. Wouldn't that be even more important at the moment than monetary policy? But forgive me for expanding on that.
Well, I do support your point. At this moment in time, I think fiscal reforms in China has a greater likelihood of both increasing consumption in China and supporting U.S. trade interests than monetary policy. And the reason is quite simple. I mean, as Nigel and Nick have said, what is really strange about China compared to other countries is that this is a socialist economy. It owns resources. It owns the land. It owns major enterprises. Now, the returns from that ownership of state assets accrues to the companies in the state, not to households. Now, that's what differentiates China from a Korea or a Taiwan or a Japan or a Brazil. In those countries, the returns to assets are private. They accrue to households, ultimately. They don't. Now, then the problem is the returns to these assets, very valuable assets, go to companies which basically don't pay any dividends, and they invest and they overinvest. They accrue to the government for various kinds of expenditures which don't necessarily benefit households directly. So the fiscal reform I was talking about is their share of tax revenues is way below normal. That's very strange for a socialist country. So if the budget could get those resources in terms of dividend payments from corporations, more taxation and explicit conditions for the government to channel returns on these assets to the budget and to fund social programs, then consumption in China would jump up dramatically. Now, consumption of health and education and social protection in China is about 40% to 50% of the normal for lower middle income countries. And that translates directly into consumption and GDP being below normal. Now, what would happen if it became normal? It would actually eliminate China's trade surplus, because aggregate demand would increase by 3 or 4 percentage points GDP. The trade deficit is only 2 to 3 percentage GDP. China's trade surplus would disappear. And U.S. may still run a deficit. That's a different issue. But in terms of the Chinese running a trade surplus, which causes a lot of political negative feedback, it more or less would moderate it significantly. And I can only see that happening, frankly, in the near term with the fiscal reform package, because the other things I was talking about take so darn long to play out, maybe 5 years or 10 years before it actually happens.
Let me just give you a somewhat different perspective. I used to think that the key was to build up the social safety net and then households would spend more, save less. But my view has changed somewhat for a couple of reasons. First of all, if you go back and look at the aggregate data on household savings, the household, and then look in the second half of the 1990s when we were undergoing this massive reorganization of state-owned enterprises, and a lot of people were losing their access to various kinds of benefit programs. The household savings rate in that period actually was declining, not increasing. The increase in the household savings rate, if you look at the flow of funds data, actually started in about 2001, 2002. It coincides with the period when the financial system became more repressive. In other words, as real deposit rates declined, households save more. And the increase is very, very substantial. You cannot rely, in my opinion, on the household survey data, which understates savings. In the 6 or 7 years before 2003, the household savings rate was about 29% of GDP. From 2004 up to the present, it's gone up to about 38% of GDP. It's very, very high. It went up about 7, 8, 9 percentage points. So, the timing of the increase in the household savings rate looks to me like financial repression is a more important factor than the decline, the weakening of the social safety net associated with the state-owned enterprise reform. The second thing you look at is if you look at other countries, and there's been some very, very good studies on Taiwan, in the 90s, in a very, very short period of time, they went from a system in which only about 40% of the population had any kind of health care insurance to one in which more than about 95% of the population had pretty good health insurance. And the increase in the consumption as a result of that change increased consumption, according to various estimates, by about 3% of GDP. Well, consumption in China today is about 34% of GDP. If it went up by 3%, that's only one percentage point increase in consumption. So I do think it's important. I do think they should do more to improve the social safety net, and they should use the mechanisms that Yukon talked about, tax the corporate sector more to provide more social services. I do expect a payoff from that in terms of increased consumption over time, but I don't think it's as much as you can get out of liberalizing interest rates. Remember, liberalizing interest rates is what I call a twofer. Number one, it will lower the savings rate, and number two, it will raise household income. And the combined effect of those two things over a period of years is easily something approaching 10% of GDP.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of more align with Nick on that. Social safety net is important in its own right. I mean, for inequality issues, for distribution issues, I mean, building out healthcare, pension reform, all of these things are very important in China. But I think, as you can see, that if you think about the decline in consumption, maybe a quarter of it was from the higher saving rate, but three quarters of it was from the loss of income from households relative to GDP. So in that world, what's really important is much more about getting money into the pockets of households than changing the saving rate. And you have to think that safety net changes. You not only have to change the safety net, you also have to convince people that that safety net's going to be around for a long, long time. In a world where you already not so long ago took away that safety net. So I think changing behavior through build out the social safety net is a very, very slow process. And so I think the final thing I'd like to mention is that although household savings is important in China, corporate savings is as big as household savings. And tackling corporate savings problem is really important. And financial reform does that for you. It extracts resources from the corporate sector, and it puts it in the hands of the household. As Yukon said, right now, there's a firewall between households and a big chunk of the Chinese corporate sector. So when corporate sector becomes more wealthy, earns more profits, has more assets, the households don't feel any benefit from that, and they don't change their saving behavior, which is very different from, say, in advanced economies. In advanced economies, you see almost one-to-one offset. If corporates save more, households tend to save less. In China, corporates save more and more, doesn't make any difference to households' behavior. So I really see financial reform as a redistribution mechanism to take resources out of the corporate sector, take their profitability out of the corporates and the banks, and put it in the hands of the households. I hope that didn't sound too Marxian for an IMF official.
Actually, it's a remarkably cogent and concise analysis. On the next to you here on the aisle, the yellow tie. Coming back. Thanks, Oliver.
Stefan Brathwaite with Fair Observer, the online international affairs journal. My question is, at least as of last year, this concerns the rulemaking environment, the legal and governance environment. As of last year, the consensus among international lawyers is that there is no such thing as a private Chinese corporation. Would you agree with that assessment?
I would say I disagree. We can track very well, the change in the ownership structure, and you know, the dominant source of growth in recent years has been household businesses, which are not even classified as firms because they have very few employees, and private enterprises. And these private enterprises operate, obviously, they operate in an environment that's affected by government policy, as private firms do everywhere. But there's no government ownership. And if you look at government ownership and include the few still what I call old-fashioned state-owned companies that are, you know, owned by the whole people, you know, the Chuanmin Soyouzhi system, which used to dominate, that accounts now for about 8% of industrial output. And if you add on all the companies that have undergone, state-owned companies that have undergone a transformation of their ownership to become a shareholding company, changes in governance, usually listing on some stock exchange, that accounts for another 20%. So you have a little bit more than 70% of manufacturing that is by firms that have no direct state ownership. And when you go to some of the services sectors I already mentioned, like construction, which is a big part of the non-manufacturing sector, it's almost entirely private. And retailing is almost entirely private. Certainly when you get to transportation, there's a huge chunk that's private. And obviously the financial sector is still mostly state-controlled. So you start looking across the whole economy, I think there are many, many truly private firms in which the state has no ownership at all.
If I could make one comment, there are clearly entities and firms which are really private in every sense of the world. If you get to large companies, I would think about them as gradations between state and private. It's very hard to define whether it's private or state. It's gradations. Suppose you're in Hunan province, and you are a totally owned, totally private company, and you have a factory or doing something there. you're very likely to have gotten privileged access to land or operating rights because of blessings from the local authorities, which you repay in various ways. But they're not owning it. Now, that's to me, on the books, it shows up as a purely private, but I would also say it's got some kind of a public flavor in there. And you have that kind of degrees of gradations. You also have private companies which have nothing to do or no kind of obligation or debt to local authorities or the state or anybody else. You have major private companies whose heads are appointed by the Communist Party, or the ownership structure of the company is purely private. So I think there are lots of these kinds of funny things going on. But I think one thing is very clear to me, is that overall the industrial sector is becoming more private. But it's very complicated in terms of what is private and what is public.
I can look on the side.
Thanks. I'm Henry Hoyle, and I'm with the Eurasia Group and also a student at SAIS. My question is more about the political economy dimensions of financial reform, as was discussed earlier. Mr. Lardy mentioned MOFCOM's role in sort of blocking or inhibiting financial reform. I'm curious to hear about any insight they might have into the role of other key players in kind of financial reform, specifically China Development Bank and the Ministry of Finance, who would seem to have strong parochial interests against financial reform in some respects. And People's Bank of China, obviously another key player who would seem to have a strong interest in reform, but perhaps less powerful. Any insights into kind of their role would be appreciated.
Well, I would agree with your hypothesis that the Ministry of Finance is hardly a big proponent of financial reform for a number of reasons. I mean, first, they like this system where there's a big spread between deposit and lending rates. The banks are highly profitable. After all, they're protecting the recapitalization that they put into the banking system in the first half of the last decade is something, I don't know, by various estimates, I can't remember what the best one is, $6 trillion US dollars or what, you know, a huge number that was injected by the state, and a large portion of those funds came from the Ministry of Finance. They issued bonds to finance part of that. They have to pay interest on the bonds. One of the things that they have gained over the years is the control of Huijin through CIC, and CIC now has the responsibility for paying interest on a $1.55 trillion bond issue that was used to raise funds to buy the $200 billion in foreign exchange from SAFE that then went into CIC as their initial capital. So CIC is responsible for paying the interest on that. And if bank and they're getting most of it from bank from dividends paid out by banks. Now, this is maybe getting down in the weeds, but it's a kind of a footnote to what Yukon said. And generally, I agree, corporations, even with big state ownership, don't pay dividends. The big exception is the banks. They are paying out a massive share of their profits in the form of dividends. They're depleting their capital. At the same time, they have to go back out to the capital markets and raise more money so that they have a shot at becoming compliant with the capital adequacy standards that are being dictated and promulgated by the China Banking Regulatory Commission. But the Ministry of Finance wants that cash flow going to Huijin, which owns all these shares of two of the biggest banks. And otherwise, they're going to be on the hook for repaying the interest on the bonds that were issued. And so that would be a big fiscal cost. So Ministry of Finance, it does not seem very enthusiastic about the kind of reform that we've been talking about today. I mean, on the other hand, of course, the central bank has been a consistent advocate for more appreciation, interest rate liberalization, getting rid of negative deposit rates, which they recognize has a very high cost. Wu Xiaoling, when she was vice governor, made a public statement saying that our very low interest rate environment has the risk of creating asset bubbles. Well, you know, when the real return on financial assets is extremely low, people go into other kinds of assets. And the most obvious example over the last 5 years has been property. So the central bank has been aware of the risks of the nature of the financial system that Nigel outlined, and they've been arguing as best they can for a kind of financial reform that's not very different from the roadmap that he laid out, but they're getting no traction because there are a lot of other vested interests that are the whole property development sector. This is an example. I mean, people always describe China, you know, all these state-owned firms have so much influence. I don't think they have that much influence. It's the construction sector, the property developers, which are almost entirely private. They're in favor of the very low interest rate environment. It keeps people going into housing and it has generated huge wealth. I mean, look at the Who Run list year after year after year. You know, the top 100 richest people in China, you know, it would not be much of an exaggeration to say 9 out of 10 of them made their money in the property sector. This is very different from the rich in Russia who got their wealth by stealing state assets at pennies on the dollar. These guys got their wealth by benefiting from a financial system that has made property development a huge cash machine. And as Yukon obliquely mentioned in his earlier remarks, sometimes some of this money gets spread around.
I guess you don't want to comment. It seems to me that if you push this to areas beyond dry economics characterizations, to flesh and blood kind of considerations, if China fails to carry out the reform, stays on the same path, continues to have its wealth generated by this liquidity available to private developers who have cozy relationships with the political system, once the reforms come in, it's going to really challenge the way politics works in China, that the ability of a local party leader to tap his access to land or water or whatever that local authority controls and then mate it up with a friendly investor from the private sector who has a lot of access to capital, you have a relationship which will be challenged. It'll challenge the way people get promoted in the party system. It'll be a systemic kind of threat to the Communist Party in ways that we have seen in other parties and other places. But that's getting on the political science of it. I want to thank you, Nick, for an extremely cogent and terse characterization of this China Investment Corporation control of Huijin and the expanding amount of debt that they owe interest payments on. I want to push
it. By the way, much more detail in Walter and Howie.
Walter and Howie's book is really, really very good on this subject. But I want to push you, if I can. The FT and others in the last couple of days, the World Economic Forum in Dalian, has been talking about China jumping in and saving the euro, buying up Greek or Italian bonds. What are the incentives for CIC or others to buy those bonds, in your view?
I think close to zero is the short answer. And if you read the details on the trip that Lo Jiwei and some others from CIC made to Italy, I mean, their timing of their trip couldn't have been worse because it was interpreted that they were thinking of buying bonds. But CIC does not really do much bond buying. They are looking to make real investments either through equity purchases or direct investments in various kinds of businesses. So I don't believe they were going there to suggest or hint that they were about to stock up on Italian government bonds. If you want to buy Italian government bonds, you don't have to go to Italy. I think it's been a setback for them because they have been going out of their way to emphasize that, perhaps not with complete credibility, that they're operating on a commercial basis, that they don't take instructions from the government, and this whole episode has portrayed them as doing the premier's bidding. But I think if you read the details, they're not likely to make significant investments. Remember, there were rumors months ago that they were going to buy a lot of Greek bonds, which never materialized. So I don't know. I could be completely wrong, but I don't think they're going to be taking big positions. They have enough euro-denominated bonds issued by the Bundesbank. I don't think they're interested in ones coming from the Italians.
We have time for a few more questions, and I think what we do is take a few together and then see what kind of responses we get. Eric McVaden on the front.
Yes, Eric McVaden, the Institute for Foreign Policy Analysis. I wonder if there are any real NGOs developing in China now that have an influence on economic endeavors I mean the things like land use and the party's control and corruption and pollution and that sort of thing.
And then Steve Schleicher had his hand up in the blue shirt back there.
I have one quick technical question about the 38% of GDP that's savings. Doesn't that include corporate savings?
Yes.
Yeah, and just to clarify that, it's not just households. Then my question to hold is the flip side of Doug's question, the political science question about what happens when all these great financial reforms that Nigel describes happen. What if they don't, for all the reasons that Nick and Yukon and others have described, all the vested interests? What would be the macroeconomic, not necessarily political, but the economic consequences, say, 5 years from now, if we just keep on doing what works in China?
One more question back on the aisle.
Hi, my name is Ying Miao, and I'm a student at Georgetown and working part-time at Treasury as well. My question is, what is your view on the idea that China's growing at the expense of other countries? I think financial repression is maybe a manifestation of one of that those ideas, like exchange rate controls and export controls, et cetera. And so I wanted to just hear your views on that, and especially in light of the European crisis and the U.S. crisis right now.
Take these three and see if we have time after that.
Maybe I'll deal with one on 5 years from now. I think that's our concern, is 5 years from now, what's China going to look like? The labor force is going to start shrinking, so you're going to see a lot more inflationary pressures from wages. You're going to have a much tougher time finding people to do construction, so you better make sure that the capital stock you put in place today is a good capital stock and is not depreciating at 20% a year because it's poorly constructed or poorly allocated. You're going to have continued problems with asset price bubbles, particularly property price bubbles, and maybe spreading into other financial assets. You're going to have a financial system that is going to become increasingly complicated, increasingly innovative, increasingly non-bank-based. And so all of these things will come together at a time that if you keep with this current model, that model just isn't going to work. You're going to have too low cost capital, too much investment, not enough jobs. Eventually that's going to run out of road. You cannot invest 50% of GDP or more per year without eventually hitting excess capacity, without eventually hitting environmental problems, without eventually hitting non-performing loans in the banking system. So it's not a great picture going forward, but I think domestically, in terms, we talked a little bit about political economy, I don't get the sense that there's a real appreciation for the risks of continuing with the current system. In fact, I think it's quite the reverse. I think in 2008, when China saw the U.S. system blow up, saw their system work extremely well in providing stimulus to the economy, I think it further reaffirmed that this system works, is an alternative to a laissez-faire capitalist system, and I think the appetite for changing it really diminished. In 2007, I think there was a trajectory towards financial reform, commercializing the banks, listing them on foreign exchanges, improving the regulatory structure, eventually moving to interest rate liberalization. And I think the appetite for that now is clearly less than it was prior to the global financial crisis.
Let me comment on a few. Let me start off with the question of whether China's growing at the expense of other countries. And I guess the first observation I'd make would that most emerging markets, most developing countries have been growing much more rapidly in the last decade than before, along with China. So it's difficult to sort out causality, but there's no obvious evidence that would say that China's growth has been at the expense of other emerging market developing countries. Now, within that group, it is clear that some countries benefited a lot more than others. Commodity-producing developing countries benefited a lot from China's growth and demand for resources. East Asia, which uses China as part of a production-sharing network, as a region has benefited from what I would call China's growth, economies of scale, and specialization. It is also true that if China's exchange rate changes, there will be countries whose situation will improve because they can move into the more of the labor-intensive activities that China should be getting out of. But there will also be some middle-income developing countries who will feel more competitive pressures from China as it moves up the technology scale. So who benefits and who loses within this group is a very complex issue, as opposed to whether the group as a whole has been suffering or not. Let me talk a little bit also about this long-term consequence. I certainly agree with both Nick and Nigel that this financial repression and the negative consequences are going to become increasingly a problem. Now, I look at the problem slightly differently. If you look at the low interest rate pays to households, actually, many people would argue that interest rates paid to households in a significant way have already been liberalized because banks now offer wealth products. And you find that most households with any significant resources are negotiating savings rates and interest rates being paid to them of a package which is quite different from the past books. So they would argue, in fact, it's actually liberal, but not so transparent or clear. But nevertheless, there's a broad range of what I call the lower households who don't get into this wealth management, who still face very low rates. Now, the rates paid by private firms for borrowing are very, very high. So it's not actually that the cost of capital is cheap for them. It's just that the access, because the financial system doesn't intermediate efficiently, they have to pay off-market rates and other kinds of rates. So you have a kind of a distortion of that form. Now, what I think is more of the issue is that as the economy becomes more private, the old system of using state banks to channel money to big state enterprises or local authorities is increasingly becoming wasteful because the kind of obvious infrastructure and things you want the state to do, they're not becoming as easy or obvious to discern. The kinds of activities you want a private economy or more complex China to be supporting needs a more liberalized and more efficient financial system. So things have changed. And I just want to make one comment about the vested interest. The great irony in China is that 10 or 15 years ago, the political scientists were writing that this is a disinterested economy because there are no vested interests. And today they're writing about this is an economy with tons of vested interests. Now, the reason they say there was no vested interest 10 or 15 years ago is because there are no big powers. Everyone needed to grow, and policy supported growth, and everyone benefited. So the interesting question is, why are there vested interests today when there were no vested interests 10 or 15 years ago? And the answer is, if you're very, very successful, vested interests emerge because you got real big profit centers. Assets become more valuable. Land is worth a lot. The right to operate is very, very valuable. Why don't they have got rid of the one-child policy? You have this huge bureaucracy of Fannie planning people who make a fortune from Fannie planning fees and fines. That's a vested interest. So everywhere along the line, you see vested interests occurring because in China, resources have become much more valuable.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being with us today. If I can spin a rustic metaphor, I think we've been sitting here looking at a very important patient with a growing heart problem, and some diagnoses about how to improve their lifestyle have been offered, and some warnings given that if they don't improve their lifestyle pretty quickly, they may have a real consequential event. This has really been terrific. Nigel and the IMF, thank you. Nick and Peterson Institute, thank you for your participation. Thank you, UConn. This has been a wonderful day. Join me in appreciating our panel.